A very important part of the Eastern Church's tradition of iconography is the legend of the Ikairopoietos icon, the legend of the icon not made with human hands, which is also linked to the Abgar legend, the story of King Abgar of Edessa, as we shall see. This legend or tradition provides the basis for not only the possibility and a kind of theology of Christian icons, but attempts to lend it a certain historical veracity, a certain connection with a real visual experience. Because as we shall see, as the legend develops, it suggests the possibility that there was an image at one time which was genuine, which really did reflect the features of Christ. And in the West, this tradition is often associated with the veil of Veronica or the notion of St. Luke having painted a portrait of the Blessed Virgin and of Christ. And so there are variants of this which are also connected in a distant kind of way, although it's more associated with the medieval spiritual tradition, with the Shroud of Turin and other similar kinds of relics. But in the Eastern Church, it's not merely a curiosity, it's intimately linked with a theology of icons, because as the tradition develops, it basically says we can make icons because Christ himself made one for us. As we'll see in the last part of the development of this tradition, the icon or the sacred image is created by Christ himself for the sake of King Abgar of Edessa. This legend is both foundational and important for the tradition of iconography, and as we shall see in the reference to it by John Damascene in about the year 730, we also catch some of the theology of Christian image making, which would be an important part of the Second Council of Nicaea, and therefore these texts are useful for us to look at from that perspective. But they are also an opportunity for us to look at the development of a tradition, the development of a legend over time, and see how it comes to acquire its final characteristics. If you wish to come back and later review this material, there is a summary given at the very top of the page of the five stages that we'll be looking at. But let's drop down now to the first section, the first dual language version of text, which is taken from Eusebius's Ecclesiastical History from the first quarter of the fourth century. And it is here that we have the earliest reference to not a miraculous image. And we shall see that in the first two stages of this, in Eusebius, and then also in the story by Egeria, there is no reference to a miraculous image, but rather a letter. The legend or tradition is that Abgar, the king of Edessa, sent a letter to Christ during Christ's lifetime, and Christ answered the letter, promising that he would see to it that a disciple was sent to evangelize Edessa and also to heal Abgar's illness. This is the tradition that we'll see in the first two stages. Then later on, the letter bearer is also an artist who paints Christ's portrait, and then in a still later stage of the development of the tradition, the portrait is not painted by the artist, but is in fact created by Christ himself and given to the messenger. But in this first and earliest reference, there is no reference to an image of Christ, but rather it is the story of the Abgar letter. If we look at the text itself, Eusebius is recounting in the early 4th century a tradition that King Abgar, and this, by the way, was the name of quite a number of rulers of Edessa, so one has to be clear which one this was, that this King Abgar lived at the time of Christ, sent a message according to the tradition by a courier, and begged the Lord to heal him of his disease. Jesus, the tradition goes, did not comply with the request, but he deemed Abgar worthy of a personal letter, and the letter was sent to him via the messenger that Abgar had sent. And then later, after Christ's resurrection, in the early tradition, Thomas the Apostle sends Thaddeus along as the one who will evangelize Edessa and heal King Abgar. But in the later tradition, it's not Thaddeus, but Thomas himself who is sent. But in this earliest strand, it is going to be Thomas who sends Thaddeus. But let's drop down in verse or section 6 to the letter from Abgar written to Christ. Again, these are legend, these are traditions, but from the 4th century onwards it was believed, particularly in Edessa itself, that this letter was genuine, and so people would debate whether or not the original form of the letter included, for example, a promise that the city of Edessa would not be conquered. Obviously, that's a part of the local tradition of the city itself. But here's an attestation of what was regarded as the earliest form of Abgar's letter to Christ. It's got a kind of a pinkish marble background, and if you drop down a little further, against a bluer background is the legendary letter from Jesus to Abgar, which, as you can see, is a kind of concatenation, a bringing together of texts from the New Testament. Blessed are you who have believed without seeing. A kind of obviously a reference to the Johannine blessing of doubting Thomas. Blessed are those who have believed and yet have not seen. Christ, in this short version, this early version of the letter, promises that, quote, I will send to you one of my disciples that he may heal your disease and give life to you and yours. And that's the extent of this message. Then, according to this tradition, Thomas sent Thaddeus, an apostle, one of the 70, to the city of Edessa. Thaddeus preaches the gospel, he lays hands on King Abgar, and Abgar is healed when he believes in Christ. And it's the beginning of the Christianization of the city of Edessa. A later version of this, remember this first attestation in Eusebius, a later version of this legend is found in the Pilgrim Diary of Egeria, a very important text of women's literature. We've noted previously that among the very few bits of literature by women that we have from the early Christian tradition, we have the diary of Saint Perpetua, we have the sayings of several of the desert mothers, and here we have a travel diary by this nun, Etheria, or Egeria, as she's most frequently called, variously dated, sometimes placed as late as the first quarter of the 5th century, but generally believed by many now to date from the end of the 4th century. She travels to the Holy Land and leaves behind a very important description of what she experiences in the holy sites. It's very important from the standpoint of liturgical history because she describes the liturgies and ceremonies that she saw performed in these various places. But here we're interested in her visit from the Holy Land up to the city of Edessa. And when she gets there, of course, they will tell her about their own traditions, and in fact she is shown what is purported to be a copy of Abgar's letter from Christ and given a copy of it herself. So if we look in chapter 17, she describes her arrival in Edessa, or at least her interest in Edessa, because according to the tradition, Jesus our God, by a letter which he sent to Abgar the king by the hand of Ananias, the courier. The name of the courier here, according to the tradition that she is recounting, is Ananias. That's the person who Abgar sent and then who carried back the message. As we'll see, this idea of Ananias becomes fused with the Syrian version of the name Adai, and so this Ananias courier becomes the same Adai who becomes an important witness to a later Syrian tradition that supposedly dates back to the time of the apostles and is important from the perspective of liturgical history as well, because there is a liturgy that is attributed to Saint Adai. But in any case, Egeria mentions her own reception of this tradition, that the letter was sent to Abgar by Ananias, the courier, with a promise, and now the promise is that he would send Saint Thomas there. It's no longer one of the 70, Thaddeus, but in fact now the tradition is developing and Edessa claims that Saint Thomas himself was sent, and the body of Saint Thomas is believed to be in Edessa as well. And the letter which Christ had sent is kept with great reverence in the city of Edessa. If we drop down now to chapter 19, a couple of paragraphs down, a highlighted text, Egeria meets the bishop who says, who shows her a statue, "Behold King Abgar, who before he saw the Lord believed in him, that he was in truth the Son of God." He, not having seen Christ, nonetheless believed in him. And the bishop told her a tradition which now refers to the defense of the city of Edessa. Remember, this is several centuries after this event allegedly took place. And now the tradition is developing that the city of Edessa will be protected. And it'll even be in the Syrian tradition that Christ promised that the city would be protected against against despoilers. And this is referred to here in the text. If you continue on, the Lord had answered King Abgar by Ananias the courier, as it is written in the letter itself. And this later King Abgar, who was defending the city against the Persians, bore the letter of the Lord to the gate with all of his army and prayed and said, "O Lord Jesus, you have promised us that none of our enemies should enter this city." So now the tradition of the letter is being added to. Now there is a promise that Edessa will be defended against enemies. And the king holding the open letter in his uplifted hand. So the letter is becoming a kind of relic, almost a talisman that prevents the enemies from attacking the city. And the result of this is that there is a great darkness which keeps the Persians from being able to attack. And so then she is told that as often as enemies determined to come and take the city, the letter was brought out and read in the gate, and all the enemies are driven back by the will of God. So by Egeria's day, a tradition is developing that this traditional miraculous letter, it's now become miraculous, has in itself not only the promise of Christ, which as we saw was not in the original text, but a promise of Christ that the city would be defended, and in fact, holding the letter up and reading it becomes a kind of a ceremony that saves the city from attack. And Egeria goes on to mention that she's very grateful to be given a copy of this letter, even though she already has one at home in her own monastery, which is believed by many to be in Spain. So the tradition of the letter of Abgar had already circulated throughout the Mediterranean, and versions of it were to be found in a variety of places. But she said she was very happy to have this copy of the version which the Bishop of Edessa gave to her. If we drop down now to the next stage in the development, not too much later, probably a couple of decades, this reflects the Syrian indigenous tradition, and I haven't given a dual language version because the original is in Syriac. And in this doctrine of Adai, which again includes a lot of other material, liturgical material as well, we now see that this individual, Ananias, has become Adai, the apostle, and becomes a link with the apostolic era. And if we drop down in this text to the highlighted portion, we'll see that Hanan is now the keeper of the archives. This is the individual who supposedly became the messenger or the courier of King Abgar. Hanan or Anon writes down everything that he saw of Christ, and then takes that back to King Abgar, and then later Abgar writes his letter, sends it to Christ by the hand of Anon. So now there are two trips to Palestine by this emissary representing King Abgar. We have in smaller type the reference to the letter of Abgar, and then with a kind of a bright background, the text of the Syrian version of the letter to Abgar. And here we have the sentence added, "Your city shall be blessed, and no enemy shall again become master of it forever." So now in the tradition in Edessa, there is this additional phrase that Christ has promised that their city will be protected against enemies. And the story also mentions that Hanan, the keeper of the archives, then, because he was also the king's painter in this version, took and painted a likeness of Jesus with choice paints and brought it with him to Abgar the king, his master. And so Abgar sees the likeness, receives it with great joy, and places it with honor in one of his palatial houses. So here, around the year 400, is the earliest reference to this picture of Christ. It's not miraculous yet. It is a painting by this emissary who also carries the letter of Christ to King Abgar. And now we have in the Syriac version the tradition that that Thomas sends to Abgar Adai the apostle, who is one of the 72. And so again, we no longer have this the tradition of Thaddeus going to Edessa, but in fact it is Adai the apostle, and as we'll see, other traditions associated with a visit by Thomas himself. And it's possible that, as we've hinted earlier, that Adai represents a conflation of or a modification of the name Ananias from the earlier tradition. Of course, the conclusion of the story is the same as in the earlier versions. King Abgar believes and is healed. Now, the church historian, if you drop down to the next section, Evagrius Scholasticus, at the end of the 6th century, in about 593, writes also about the letter and the image, but now the tradition, over the intervening more than a century, has developed that the image was not painted, but was in fact a miraculous image. Evagrius Scholasticus is not specific about how it was created. We'll find reference to that just a little bit later on. But Evagrius Scholasticus, who tries to evaluate texts carefully, if you drop down to chapter 27 of book 4 of Evagrius Scholasticus's Ecclesiastical History, he recounts the tradition of the letter sent to Christ, and he points out that although Edessa claims that there was this additional phrase, that the city would never fall into the hand of an enemy, he points out this assertion is not contained in what was written to Abgar by Christ our God. That is to say, the Greek tradition is now saying, well, wait a minute, in the versions of the letter that we have, we don't have any of this guarantee that Edessa will remain unconquered. So there's a certain amount of critical scholarship intervening into the legend. But he does mention the existence of this miraculous image, what he calls the divinely wrought image, Theotukton Eikona, which he goes on to say, which the hands of men did not form, but Christ our God sent to Abgar on his desiring to see him. Intriguing is that this miraculous portrait is now the talisman, or is the miraculous thing that is protecting the city of Edessa. Not primarily the letter, but it's stated that during this assault of the Persians, who were constantly a problem as far as Edessa was concerned, in this account there was a tunneling under the besiegers and an attempt to light a fire under their siege works, which wasn't successful until, and you can notice in this highlighted text, having introduced the holy image into the mine and washed it over with water, they sprinkled some upon the timber. So now this image of Christ is being used as a kind of source of miraculous water. It's water is placed on it, dripped off onto something else, and suddenly now the water itself becomes the source of miraculous salvation of the city. So again, you have this this development from now it's not the letter, now it is the image of Christ that is protecting the city of Edessa. And finally, if we drop down to the last section, we have a general description by John Damascene of the value of images. This is from within the heart of the iconoclastic controversy, and we will talk about that a little bit more later. But Damascene is describing the reason why images are acceptable and permissible. And if you look down in chapter 16, he quotes St. Basil the Great, who says that the honor given to the image passes over to the prototype. So if you are honoring an image, you are actually honoring that of which the image is itself a representation. So honoring the image gives honor to God, he says. He addresses the question, you know, how can you possibly depict the formless, uncircumscribed God? And his answer is, the Word has become flesh. We may now, because of the incarnation, depict Christ. After God became in truth man for our salvation, he says, all these things were seen and took place. Therefore, we can make images because God made himself capable of being seen through images. God took flesh, therefore we may accept and carry on what God has already done. God became flesh so that he could be seen, and now we can create visible representations of the God who allowed himself to be seen. And then finally, in a highlighted and lighter text, we find him recounting briefly the story of Abgar and giving us a hint as to the tradition of how the image was miraculous, how it was created. And he says, when Abgar the king over the city of Edessa sent a portrait painter to paint a likeness of the Lord, it's almost as if the letter is being forgotten now, this tradition says the painter could not paint because of the brightness that shone from his countenance. And so the Lord put a garment, a himatia, a kind of a veil over his own divine and life-giving face, and impressed on it an image of himself, and sent this to Abgar to satisfy thus his desire. So the image of a veil or a cloth that is pressed to the face of Christ and retains his image in this version is connected with the Abgar legend. And it becomes known as the icon not made with human hands, sometimes called the Mandylion. And it's also associated, obviously, as we mentioned at the beginning, in the West, with the tradition of Veronica's veil, of a woman who applies a cloth to the face of Christ during his passion on his way to the cross, and there too the image of Christ is miraculously rendered. These are traditions that one finds both in the East and the West, but one can find here a development of the tradition that is helpful and also gives us a sense of how it is used, how it becomes a part of the rationale for the value and importance of using icons, particularly in the theology, as we have seen, of St. John Damascene.